All right, our next case is United States v. Bush, number 21-3071. Counsel, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. John Arcisi from the Federal Defender's Office in Denver, appearing for Appellant George Bush. Your Honors, we've raised two errors with respect to the aggravated role enhancement. We've raised two errors with respect to the aggravated role enhancement here, but they boil down to the same problem. And that is that the district court applied the enhancement in April of 2021 based on a misrecollection of what it had found in December of 2020. So let me unpack that. Specifically, in its April order, the court applied a three-level enhancement for being a manager supervisor. The sole basis it gave for doing so was that it had previously found Mr. Bush to be a manager supervisor.
Well, didn't he take into account the fact that Mr. Bush, from his house or his father's house, was the one in charge of distributing the various amounts of drugs to the other co-conspirators?
And I don't think it went quite that far that he was distributing drugs to the co-conspirators so much as Mr. Bush had a central, even indispensable role in this. Drugs, you know, this was a family, and drugs was the family business in many ways. And then Mr. Bush had an indispensable role in that. But indispensability is not the same as the indicia of control necessary. And the court never made specific findings in December or in April about that, other than a conclusory assertion at the April 13th hearing that there was ample evidence.
Well, what it says is, if he was a manager or a supervisor. Now, wasn't he a supervisor in distributing various amounts of drugs to the couriers or to the co-conspirators? Doesn't that fit into that category?
No, I don't think that's what the record shows. I don't think there's...
Well, it shows clear as a bell that he was the one that was distributing the packages to each of the individuals.
Well, I think it shows that he played a role in cooking drugs, in managing the premises, but that's not necessarily managing the people, right? These people were independent contractors in many ways. They were functioning independently.
Well, a manager or a supervisor, but not an organizer or a leader. There's got to be a differential there.
There is a differential, but it's not inevitable that it has to be one or the other, right? And so the court at the December, I think if we turn to the December hearing, it really gives us a clear indication of what the court found. And the court considered these and found it to be accurate.
Quickly on that, you say it doesn't necessarily have to be one or the other. Is it your position that it was neither?
I think there's a compelling argument at remand that it is neither. But that doesn't mean that nothing happens under 3B1.1. The guidelines expressly contemplate that situation under Note 2, which is perhaps you don't meet either definition, but there's still a basis for a departure for playing a greater role in the offense than is otherwise required. And I think that's what the parties probably should have turned to. Now, whether that is zero, or one, or two, or three levels, that's for the district court to sort out on remand. But yeah, I think there's a compelling argument that it is needed here. And that, frankly, that's what the court should have found after...
Is it your contention to get down to the nub that really what the district court did was all over the map and he never really explained what his final position or his final findings were?
I think at brass tacks, you can't rely on a finding you never made to meet your obligation to make a finding in the first instance. And that's the problem here, is that in December, the court not only did not make the finding about a manager supervisor, in fact, its December ruling is contrary to the legal standard for applying the manager supervisor enhancement.
Well, he went from 4 to 3 to 2 to go back and, but he did hit on the packaging and the fact that the guy was in charge of the house.
Yeah, and in December, we considered these things.
And this is a 4-day sentencing hearing, wasn't it?
Yeah, and to be clear, I'm not faulting the district court. This was in the height of the pandemic. This was extensive objections raised over the course of 4 sentencing hearings. I've never seen a sentencing hearing record this long. And I think the court just, you know, this was a smaller piece of the larger obligations. You can understand how it happened. But it added 5 years to the guideline range that applied. And it's precisely the situation contemplated in Savio and Romano, where the cost of correction is so low that, and the error is so plain, that it warrants a remand to just get it right here. And again,
there was stumbling, unquestionably, but at the end of the day, at the end of the last sentencing hearing, doesn't the district court say, here's where I am, I now see the error of my ways on the two levels, and I'm going to go with three levels, and any comment, counsel? To which counsel said, no comments. In other words, not only am I not faulting the district court for the pandemic or other problems, but the court asked, please tell me. And it would have been very simple to say, Judge, you haven't made a finding on control.
Yes, so let me answer that in two ways. I'm not going to say this is best practices of preservation, okay? I'm not taking that position. Is it good enough? Yeah, I think it is. I'll tell you why, and then I'll tell you why I don't think it matters, okay? The defendant, Mr. Bush's counsel, did ask for clarification. I agree, I don't dispute, he didn't ask for it on those precise grounds. But he did ask for clarification, and the government characterized his objection. This was in the bits at, the government at some point during its recitation of this discussion did characterize it as Mr. Bush is seeking some sort of clarification of the court's ruling. And so I think the parties understood that it wanted the court to explain more. But I can't emphasize how little I think it matters in this case, because both the failure to explain and the stark legal error utterly satisfy the plain error standard here. So even if we are in plain error, we've got prongs one and two. And then I think the Gehrman case answers prong three. And at that, I point to page 1083 and note 13 of Gehrman, in which this court is looking at its prior decision in York. And what it says is that if there are indications in the record that a different outcome under the correct legal standard might apply, then that's all the defendant needs to do to show a reasonable probability of a different outcome on remand. We have that exactly here, because we have the district court at the December hearing saying, I am not applying the manager-supervisor role, I'm not applying the organizer-leader role under the four-level enhancement, I am applying an organizer role under Valdez-Arellano. And this court's decision in Valdez-Arellano stands only for the proposition that you apply a two-level enhancement under subsection C for being an organizer when there is not indicia of control. It is about as plain as day that is what the court was doing. The suggestion that the court was simply articulating a legal standard that it wasn't applying, I think, is directly contradicted by the record.
Counsel, speaking of plain, are you conceding that this issue is here on plain error review?
Listen, I think there's a case for preservation. We made it in our opening brief. I count no fewer than six objections to this particular enhancement, to the PSR in written form, to multiple times at the December hearing asking for reconsideration, and then again at the April hearing asking for clarification. But as Judge Phillips pointed out, I can't disagree that the precise formulation wasn't made. So is it good enough? I think it is, but if it's not, it doesn't matter. So even if we're under plain error review, I think we meet that standard very easily. And again, I want to go back to this because I think it's really important, is pages 2244 of volume 2, where the court has concluded its recitation of and its analysis of the facts and factors that you look at under 3B1.1. And then it says, consistent with the holding in Valdez-Arellano, the court concludes that the government has failed to meet burden, and consistent with the holding in Valdez's case, the court concludes, as did the Valdez case, that the defendant may be punished as an organizer under guidelines section 3B1.C for the Valdez-Arellano language that concludes with coordinating and overseeing the implementation of a conspiracy, even though he may not have had hierarchical control over other participants. Later in the same hearing, the court did sort of inadvertently to say manager-supervisor. Don't dispute that. It then corrected that and clarified in response to the government asking if that's what it was finding, that it wasn't correcting that he was a manager-supervisor. This is on page 2252, and these two remarks, I think, they're not the whole ballgame, but they're about 8 innings of our argument, right? That was my intent. I probably carelessly lumped the words together. I don't think there's any question in my mind about Mr. Bush playing a role in this organization that he was an organizer, but one other than described by subsections A and B. I think the court was very clear in December, and in April it simply didn't reconcile with that tension. It's inconsistent and indeed irreconcilable, and that's where the error arises here. And again, as this court said in Henry, it's better to know on remand than to guess on appeal.
Well, counsel, what do you do, though, with the evidence that he instructed one of his co-conspirators on how to cook heroin, reprimanded one of his co-conspirators regarding sale of inferior heroin, and his managing the drug trafficking activity at the home? I mean, it's one thing to say you got to manage people, but it is a fair inference that if you're managing drug trafficking activity at home, you're managing people. What do you do with that?
Yeah, so sort of two responses to that. One is, I think we want to, A, the district court considered all of that at the December hearing and nonetheless found it to be lacking, right? It found it necessary to invoke Valdez-Arriaga and to apply the enhancement based on the absence of control. So I think we actually have findings that are contrary to that, that we should credit and that not be engaged in appellate fact-finding. So I don't think we're even should be looking at that, is the first answer. The second answer is that I think, yes, on our remand, you'd be fighting on that on appeal. But I think that all of that evidence, while indicative of, you know, extensive evidence of drug dealing here, right, is not necessarily indicative of control. Unsurprisingly, that's why the court went to Valdez-Arriaga. It's sort of summary remarks at the April hearing that there's lots of evidence here. That's been rejected by this court in Marquez as being sufficient to meet the court's fact-finding obligations. And with respect to, so we don't actually have a district court making those specific articulations about the facts that Your Honor has sort of identified. And those facts, I think, can cut both ways, right? Just because you're cooking doesn't mean that you're controlling. That's his role in the joint endeavor of this sort of family conspiracy.
But supervising.
It's not the cooking, even this idea that he was up under, that other people were up under him, the district court rejected that. The idea that he controlled something on the premises, again, it's not a control over people. And as the court recognized, this is also in 2244, the court recognized that, you know, he had this feeling, very candidly acknowledged, that after looking at all the evidence, he had this feeling of he's central, he's indispensable. But there's surprisingly little there. And so I think that most of those factual things we even shouldn't be looking at, and that I think Garamond tells us we don't look at when there are affirmative indications in the record that, that the district court has made findings that would support the opposite outcome.
So what did the district court need to do? Say, here is participant one, and that person's name is such and such, and the defendant here controlled that person in this regard, and so X levels.
Certainly enough.
Is there something less?
There's probably a space between that and the sort of summary conclusory statements that Mark has rejected. I think there's a space between that, but I think that what you just articulated is the best practices under this court's cases for applying Chapter 3. I think at minimum here, the court needed to address and reconcile the tension between the findings that it had previously made and then explain why it was rejecting them, why, after finding that there wasn't control, it was now finding that there was, and identify, you know, under the Chapter 3 cases,
you say
what
that
was.
A family business, and I was confused going through the various records, whose brother, and whether that's a term of affection or blood relation.
I think there's a number of folks who are cousins here. And Mr. Bush's dad. It was Mr. Bush's father's house.
It was Mr. Bush's 90-year-old father's house.
Yeah.
And the person who was in control of that house is Bush Jr., the defendant here. Mm-hmm. Why isn't that enough for control? If you don't do what I say, you can't come in my house anymore.
Yep, and I think to note two answers that that control over premises is the same as people. I preserve my last 2 seconds if I could. But.
You've got 2 seconds.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Javier Sinha on behalf of the United States. I just begin with the facts in this case. We disagree that there's no facts showing that he had control or supervision over others. The District Court made clear fact findings that Bush, as Judge Matheson pointed out, reprimanded one person for selling inferior heroin, directed another on how to cook heroin. There's evidence that Bush controlled the activity within the Bush house. There's evidence that Bush was involved in every aspect of the organization, like collecting and dispensing drug proceeds.
So all very general, though. Does the District Court ever say, you, Mr. Bush, exercise control over fill in the blank by fill in the blank?
The court then never said that, Your Honor. But two quick points on that. This court's case law, especially in Apps, says the court doesn't need to do that. The court can just say, you know, there was control here, or even make implicit findings of control, and that's enough to support the enhancement. Mm-hmm. The second thing is, we know the court knew the correct standard because it was given that standard multiple times by both parties. Both parties in the sentencing memoranda explained the correct standard that was control over another. And on the fourth day, the government said multiple times, about 4 or 5 times, the correct standard is control over another. It went so far as to cite the guideline section that includes that standard. And the government actually said the court did indeed apply that standard here.
Well, let me ask you the question then. Can you answer that? Mr. Bush exercised control over and then give me a name by doing something. And how that would be controlled instead of just two drug co-conspirators working for each other's benefit.
Sure, I can answer that. I want to make a quick point first, is that this court has said we look at the totality of the circumstances, so we don't need to parse each fact, you know, separately, so we look at the facts in total.
You need a participant.
True, the court found there's at least 5 here.
And a participant has to be a person.
Correct.
And that person has to be controlled by the defendant. And so that's what I'm asking you is, fill in those blanks for me so that I know it's, I hear the under you and I hear the help cook heroin and so forth, and I can find a name for those. But that sounds like drug conspirators helping each other out. That doesn't sound like control. Control to me is, take this down to the corner and bring me back $500 and be quick about it. Or go get the drugs or take this money or something like that. We don't have anything like that that I'm aware of.
So I think the question for this court on appeal is not whether or not we agree this is a fact that shows control, it's whether the district court clearly erred in making that finding. So the district court here found that, for example, Bush instructed Albert Brown on how to cook heroin. That's a finding of control. The question for us is, was that clearly erroneous?
Why is that control? What is being controlled?
I think the instructing on how to cook heroin isn't an aspect of control. It's just telling someone how to do something and the person follows your direction. I think there's reprimand of Matthew Bush as well.
Any law on that, that if you show someone how to make heroin better or the way that you like it, and you're all relatively equals in the operation, that that's control?
I don't have any case on point for that, Your Honor. But the case law simply says, on clear error review, we look at what the district court found and say, was that a clearly impermissible finding? And I don't think it's quite impermissible to say that, you know, the court, having seen the evidence and presided over trial, determined that that was control enough to support a 3-point enhancement here. Especially when we have it, as we said, so many times the court was told the correct standard. It was in the memorandum. It was mentioned multiple times on the fourth day of the hearing. And of course, as Your Honor's pointed out, Mr. Bush never objected on the fourth day of the hearing when the government said multiple times that this is the correct standard that's exercising control here.
Castle. Could you respond to Mr. Arcicci's argument about findings? It seems like the argument this morning is turning into maybe an argument about what the findings the court made and whether they're in conflict with some of the comments about the evidence. And I'm just interested in hearing your response to that argument.
So the court on the third day made the findings we just discussed. And then it seemed to suggest that Bush was maybe an organizer, and gave him 2 points. Then later suggested again that Bush was a manager, a supervisor. And so the court admittedly got confused on the third day. But the district court here did exactly what we want district courts to do. We objected and said the district court actually on this fact should be applying a three-point enhancement. The court went back, looked at the law, and said, that's correct. If there's five participants, and Bush is a manager supervisor, it's a three-point enhancement. And so we don't think that third day is a finding that Bush, or the finding that the court made that Bush exercised no control. The court just got a bit confused and corrected itself, which is what we want courts to do when there's an objection, and then go back and look at the law and fix it. And so on the fourth day, if Mr. Bush had a problem with that, he could have objected, which he did not. The government mentioned the standard multiple times. And the court, again, sua sponte, because Bush, of course, didn't object, said that just to be clear about the factual basis in this case, there's abundant evidence that Mr. Bush managed to provide a drug trafficking operation. And of course, that operation was operated at Mr. Bush's house, and so Mr. Bush was in charge of the activity in the house and the people there. I want to quickly contest the idea that Mr. Bush's request for clarification on the fourth day was an objection. Mr. Bush asked for clarification on the fact that there's two conspiracies charged here, and he wanted to know which conspiracy the court found Mr. Bush managed or controlled. The court rejected that as based on a false premise because the guideline says he controlled criminal activity, not controlled a specific conspiracy. And so Mr. Bush's objection in no way led the district court to the idea that he thought the court was applying the incorrect legal standard or that the court didn't adequately explain its fact findings. This court has said that the objection has to be definite enough to allow the district court to know the specific basis for an objection. And while Bush did object to the fact that the facts here, he said, did not support the enhancement, that's very different from saying the court is applying the incorrect legal standard, but the court did not find Bush had control over another. I quickly point out, as this court has mentioned in an act, specific that if this is a plain error review, which we believe it is, Bush also can't satisfy the third and fourth problems because, again, he could have simply asked the court to name a person, which the district court could have easily done on this record. Your Honors, I'm happy to answer any more questions about this point. If there are no further questions, we're happy to rest on our briefs.
Well, I've got a question about the issue we haven't talked about yet this morning, which is the determination of the drug quantity. And there was an argument about whether the district court's reliance on statements was justified. And in particular, just my question is this. We have Mr. Blewett is one of the sources that the court relied upon. And there was evidence that at least at one point, Mr. Blewett had lied to law enforcement about his participation in the drug conspiracy, which left me wondering, what does it mean to say, as the court did, that his statement about amounts that he sold was sufficiently reliable? How do we apply that standard when we have evidence in the record that he'd lied to law enforcement? How could it then be sufficiently reliable?
So this court's case law has explained that the standard for determining reliability is a minimum indicia of reliability. And so the district courts consider that the fact that Blewett initially lied, but then when he was confronted, he came clean and decided to tell the truth. And the court said that when he told the truth, those statements were corroborated by significant evidence in the record. So for example, here the court found that three separate statements from confidential informants corroborated Blewett's statement that he sold them heroin. His statements were consistent with evidence at trial that Bush and his co-conspirators sold signature coins of heroin. He gave statements to the police, indicated statements that were self-incriminating, which this court has said are indicators of reliability. And so the court looked at those factors and said, that's reliable despite the fact that he may have initially began lying, which of course is a natural thing for people to do when they can talk about the police. And so the question is, was that clearly erroneous finding? And then under this court's case law, it was not clearly erroneous.
So that we review that for clear error.
That's correct, Your Honor. And so the question is, was that a clearly permissible finding? And because it was corroborated and consistent with so much other evidence, the district court was well within its discretion to make that, or excuse me, well within its ability to make that finding, but that wasn't clearly erroneous. Your Honor, if there are no more questions, we're happy to rest our briefs. Thank you very much.
Mr. Arcici. Do you want one sentence? I'll give you one sentence.
Unless the court has questions, I yield my 2 seconds.
All right. We'll remember that for next time. Well, that completes the arguments. The case will be submitted, and counsel are excused. And the court will take its break at this point.
Thank you.